going into Iraq will actually aid and assist and fuel the very terrorists who we talk about trying to stop.
The point of our resolution was to make sure that we did go into such action with international support.
The Democrats rolled over on the war issue. They basically approved going to war with Iraq before the election.
The United States of America deliberately and willfully provided Iraq with the chemical, biological, and radiological materials necessary to effectively use chemical warfare against Iran and the Iraqi Kurds, and then against the U.S.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, November 22nd, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The 107th Congress adjourned for the year today after sending President Bush legislation creating the Department of Homeland Security, but failing to prevent nearly 1 million people from losing unemployment benefits right after Christmas. On the subject of counterterrorism, U.S. authorities hope newly captured chief of Al-Qaeda Persian Gulf operations, Abdulrahim al-Nashiri, will shed light on alleged terror plots in the works. President Bush praised the arrest, saying we're making progress in the war against terrorists. Russian President Vladimir Putin told President Bush today the United States should not wage war alone against Iraq and questioned whether White House allies like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are doing enough to fight terrorism. Well, the first military resistor for what might be the Gulf War II has stepped forward. U.S. Army Private Wilfredo Torres says he's been absent without leave or AWOL for nearly a year because he wants no part of a war against Iraq. Todd Ensign, director of Citizen Soldier, is representing his case and says the 19-year-old found Uncle Sam's pitch didn't quite deliver the goods.
He joined the Army, like most young people today, partly because he, wanted to serve his country, but also very strongly because he had been told that he would receive skills training and that he would receive college assistance. When he got to basic, he learned that the skills training he'd been promised in cooking and restaurant sort of work was not going to be his assignment. And two, he suffered a lot of harassment during basic, which he felt was partly driven by a personal vendetta by one of the drill instructors.
Mm-hmm.
So he left basic and he went AWOL. But at the same time, he also has, political beliefs. And he had, followed the issue, being Puerto Rican, of Vieques. And he, like I think most Puerto Ricans, was opposed to what our Navy and Marine Corps was doing down there. And secondly, I think he formed an opinion about the whole drift towards war with Iraq. And he came to us and said that he wanted to go back to the military, but he wanted to, speak out and be public on these issues. We agreed to support him, and he surrendered actually at an anti-war rally among veterans here in New York on the eve of Veterans Day.
Mm-hmm. What's the status of his case at this time?
Well, I was just called actually last night by one of the personnel out at the base in Fort Knox, and they told me that Wilfredo was going to be separated with an other-than-honorable discharge administratively.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, it means that he would be not court-martialed, but instead would be given a bad discharge and essentially separated from the military. In this case, that's a good outcome because we were prepared to defend him using international law arguments and other arguments, that have been raised about the what appears to be the drift towards a unilateral action over there. We've gone to the UN and asked them for a resolution to empower inspectors, but President Bush has been pretty clear, and the others in his administration as well, that they reserve to themselves the right to determine if there is a material breach. In other words, they have never said we will go back to the UN and seek their support for the next phase.
So, if it had been found that Mr. Torres, if he had won his case on the basis of that this was a illegal action, then that would sort of empower every military person in the armed forces to be able to to make a similar case or decision as to whether or not they feel like the war is legal?
Theoretically, yeah, it could very much. It posed the threat, possible only, of a precedent. You're absolutely right that then others could say, and in fact, we have been receiving, you know, at Citizen Soldier, we get calls from people, as you would expect with the mobilization going on now. We've been hearing from reservists, particularly reservists, who are being told that they can be activated for up to 2 years and sent to a war, which many of them are very dubious about. You know, it's pretty clear from the public opinion polls that while people are very upset about terrorism and they're very, you know, concerned about, you know, the whole thing with bin Laden, the support for a unilateral attack on Iraq is actually very
very
small.
Thin, yes.
And my own guess is that if we try to do that, we do that, and we get involved in a protracted, ugly, bloody urban war, my prediction is very quickly in this country you will see a sea change against military action. So I think the Bush people are smart enough to know that. I think they realize that they're on thin ice here, and that's probably why they'll wait a while at least before they do anything in terms of a so-called breach of the inspection resolution.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Mr. Torres has been harassed by one of his officers.
Yeah, at basic training, he was he believed, and what he told me was credible, that he was singled out for particular harassment by one of his drill instructors. He didn't say that he felt that was related to being Puerto Rican, but there was almost a vendetta against him. One of the things that convinced him to leave was he went to his chaplain, you know, which is an Army officer, who he was told to do. And he went to the chaplain, and he told him about the problems he was having with his drill instructor. And when he returned to the unit, in his view, the harassment increased, so that, in his view, the chaplain was not acting as a neutral voice, but instead was going to the drill instructor and informing him about the confidences that Wilfredo had given him.
What kind of harassment was he experiencing?
Well, in fact, at one point the drill instructor threatened him with physical violence. He told him that if he didn't get out of his face that minute, he was going to that he would be very sorry, or something like that. He felt very much physically at risk, that his safety, that his health and safety were at risk, which is why, as I say, he initially left. Then after being away, as I say, he formed opinions and had opinions about Vieques already, but he also began to form opinions about the Iraqi invasion. I don't think that's unusual. I mean, you're talking about young people who often, you know, enter the military with no real understanding of what it would mean to be a soldier, what it would mean to be a part of an invasion force.
But isn't there a way to serve without going to the war?
Well, he could have filed as a conscientious objector. That is a right within the military. People do file every year. When I interviewed him, I concluded that he really was not a conscientious objector. That requires you to have a belief in an opposition to all war. In other words, any wars or any use of organized violence, you must be opposed to that. And Wilfredo, that is not his philosophic belief. So I advised him that he really was not eligible, you know, to qualify as a conscientious objector. Those folks do, if they win their case, they are sometimes assigned, like you say, to noncombatant duties.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you're with Citizen Soldiers. During the first Gulf War, more than 13,000 U.S. soldiers refused to serve for political reasons. Do you perhaps foresee that Wilfredo's case as being a start of a similar movement?
Well, we have been calling him the first refuser to what we're calling Gulf War II, which I think it really has to be called that. I don't see that being a lot different from Gulf War I. Other than, of course, that we in that war had the more willing support of other allies. I think that he could be seen that way. There may well be others who in other parts of the world have come forward. I don't want to make a claim that I can't support. I think, as I said earlier, that if the war is protracted more than just a matter of a week or two, which I think it could well be, I think that very quickly, especially the reservists, people, you know, who after all were recruited to work on the weekends to be part of some reserve unit are being sent over there and being placed in harm's way. I think you could very quickly see, and it's not because of cowardice or because people don't love or support this country. It's because they question whether this is a wise course and where this could possibly lead. You know, there are many people, I think, that believe that going into Iraq will actually, in the long term, aid and assist and fuel the very terrorists who we talk about trying to stop, because it presents us, as you know, as a unilateral voice poised against, in some ways, Islam. And that in the long term, could be very, very harmful to our efforts to eradicate or stop terrorism.
Now, I have a feeling, Mr. Ensign, that people listening to this interview might be thinking, well, you know, this young man signed up during peacetime and he was lured in by the promises of skills training, et cetera, and mm-hmm. traveling. And, mm-hmm. you know, and suddenly there's a war on the horizon mm-hmm. and he just said, hey, well, this is not really what I signed up for mm-hmm. and tried to find a way to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes, I imagine there would be, there's probably quite a lot of folks, maybe not your listeners, but probably many people in this country that would put that interpretation to his decision. All I can say is that I remember in the last war there was a young woman who named Stephanie Atkinson, who we represented, and she was asked that very question by a reporter. He said, well, you know, you signed up, you took the pay, you served all these years in the National Guard, and now when they tell you you've got to go to war, you're saying, I don't want to go. And she said, well, you know, I was 18 years old when I signed up. I didn't know anything about the world or the wars. And now I'm 24. And she said, would you want me to be frozen at all times with the same information and naivete that I had then? I've come to believe that this war is against our national interests, is not wise, and it's probably illegal. And I thought that was a good answer. I mean, people do get information as they grow, and in Wilfredo's case, I think when he went in, he didn't probably could have trouble pointing out Iraq on a map of the world. But, you know, he talks to others, he reads things, and he's affected by these movements, and he decides that he's not going to be part of it. I think, actually, it's a very courageous thing to do. The easiest thing to do is maybe come up with some medical malady or some other way to try to shirk your duty, or as we have with the case of all the administration people, except for Colin Powell, no one who ever actually put on the military's uniform, other than as a member of a guard unit.
Todd Ensign of Citizen Soldier. President Bush himself sought refuge from the war by joining the Texas Air National Guard, which placed him at a low risk for serving in combat. Doug Rocky is an Army health physicist with 35 years in the military. He's currently a major in the Army Reserves. He was head of the Army's depleted uranium project after the Gulf War. He himself suffers from uranium poisoning and has a 40% disability. On November 10th, Rocky appeared in New Haven, Connecticut as part of a speaking tour. Reading from several documents from different high military and Defense Department officials, he showed that for every order to clean up the environment and treat both American service personnel and Iraqi citizens exposed to DU, there was a contradictory order declaring that medical care and environmental remediation weren't necessary. He said even though severe health impacts were evident from depleted uranium, he had orders to downplay those impacts because DU was a very effective military weapon that the Defense Department did not want to see withdrawn.
During the Gulf War and prior to the Gulf War, the United States of America deliberately and willfully provided Iraq with the chemical, biological, and radiological materials necessary to effectively use chemical warfare against Iran and the Iraqi Kurds and then against the U.S. So as started the ground war and started the war in Iraq, we knew what he had and we knew where he had it. As a consequence, we made a conscious decision that what we would do was to blow those materials up in place. This is like hitting an ice cube with a hammer. As anybody that's a specialist and has materials or any type of individual thing like that, you know that you can't just hit it with a hammer or blow it up. You have to have it under confinement at high temperature for a specific amount of time in order to destroy it. And as a consequence, Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles and radiological materials were spread all over the entire region, causing tremendous health and environmental problems. As the Gulf War started, I got recalled basically onto duty, and I was a part of what's called a command assessment team teaching nuclear and biological chemical warfare procedures, techniques, protection, and emergency response to the U.S. troops for the 4th U.S. Army region. In November of 1990, I was recalled to active duty, assigned to the 12th Preventive Medicine Detachment, which was the theater public health department, as the theater health physicist. And what that means is an expert in nuclear and biological chemical warfare to include radiological materials and hazardous materials. Saddam did possess chemical and biological and radiological materials because the United States deliberately provided those to him. People were sick right away because of U.S. actions. The men, the women, the children of the world who were exposed were sick right away and are sick today. We put the warnings out. We said we needed to do something, and it was ignored. We went to the ground war. And during the ground war, they had forgot about one thing. They had not bothered to tell anybody about how do you respond and provide medical care or clean up depleted uranium munitions that were shot up all over the place. In that 100-hour ground war, and a little bit with the air war, which started back on January 16th, we shot over 1 million rounds of uranium munitions. We left over 350 tons of uranium-238 contaminated with plutonium, neptunium, and americium, as verified by the United States Department of Energy reports, throughout the region. There's only three words that can describe what we saw. Oh, my God. Within 72 hours of us getting up there, we all started getting sick. We started developing respiratory problems. We started developing the rashes, and the rashes to this day are still open. And the rash, what it does is an open sore that breaks open and bleeds, and then it heals, and then it breaks open and bleeds in another point. The United States took its radioactive waste from Paducah, Kentucky, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Portsmouth, Ohio, made it into weapons, and spread it all over the world's backyard. You can't do that anyplace in the world without going to jail, but the U.S. did it not only during the Gulf War, but they did it in the Balkans. They did it in Vieques, Puerto Rico. They did it in Okinawa. And they refused to provide medical care. They refused to provide environmental remediation. In June of 1991, the order was given to provide medical care for all of the DU casualties. Very cut and dried, not even a question. However, even years later, the United States Department of Defense, Dr. Bernard Rotzker, stated very specifically in the memorandums here, that at the time of the Gulf War, the decision was made that we didn't need to provide medical care. The written directive from the theater says, provide medical care. The Deputy Secretary of Defense says, we decided not to. In January of 1993, the United States Journal Accounting Office came out with their first report on us, based on all the input, that said, you better do a medical, you better do environmental, and you better do training and education. As the investigating officer for friendly fire and verification of uranium munitions used during the Gulf War, my count was a little over 120 individuals survived DU impact friendly fire incidents during the Gulf War. As of the other day, less than 60 of those individuals have ever received medical care from the Department of Veteran Affairs or the Department of Defense. Individuals that I personally called and asked to go to the Gulf War and to help with this died of cancer, abandoned by the Department of Veteran Affairs. Abandoned by the Department of Defense. You cannot, ladies and gentlemen, take uranium waste and spread it all over a battlefield, refuse to do medical care, refuse to do environmental cleanup, and walk away. And we're going to do it again. They don't want the truth out. Because although the numbers in the Gulf War casually figure at the completion of the ground war were very low, very low, we had total of 294 dead and a little over 400 wounded for a total casualty count of 760. As of May of this year, 2002, the United States Department of Veteran Affairs has awarded service-connected combat injuries to over 160,000 Gulf War veterans, and over 8,000 have died. Now, at the completion of the ground war, when we came back in October of 1991, I had a total of 294 dead. Now I've got over 8,000 dead. and have got over 160,000 sick or injured or ill. However, the Gulf War didn't end in the fall of 1991. What happened is we continue, and to this day, we continue to send troops into this contaminated area. Since 1991, an additional 60,000 individuals that have served in that region have now been awarded VA disability. 60,000. They weren't there during combat. They went in afterwards, which means that the contamination that's present, or the immunizations, that anthrax vaccine that's disastrous, is making them sick, and another 2,000 have died. The United States General Accounting Office has verified in their recent report that the gas mask, the protective equipment issued to the United States military forces at this time, is defective and leaks. In other words, you put a gas mask on to prevent yourself from sucking in the poison gases, and because the thing leaks, you're going to suck it in. And that's the reason that when we look at the total numbers of all the troops that have served in the Persian Gulf area since August of 1990, we're looking now at a disability rate of 250,000 troops. Over one-third of the troops, the American veterans that served in the Gulf War, are now on VA disabilities. And over 10,000 are dead. I, as a military officer, do not want anybody going back into this contaminated area, and I want to make sure medical care and environmental cleanup is done. What do? Real simple. We write the president, we write the senators, the congressmen. We cite the reports. We give the information. We tell the truth. Because, ladies and gentlemen, as I learned in Vietnam 30-odd years ago, the way you stop a war is you make the cost of war so high that nobody will ever allow it to happen.
Doug Rocky is an Army health physicist with 35 years in the military. Sonoma County, California high school and college students walked out of their classes Wednesday to protest a possible war against Iraq. Smaller protests occurred on other high school campuses, including Anali High School in Sebastopol and Petaluma High School. The rallies and marches were part of a National Student Day of Resistance initiated by Not in Our Name, an anti-war group founded after the September 11th terrorist attacks to protest U.S. foreign policy. In New York City, over 1,000 students took to the streets. Six of them came from the Institute for Collaborative Education, and their decision to leave class has resulted in disciplinary action from the school administration. We spoke earlier with Peggy Werns, the mother of one of the students.
On that day, the principal had said to the kids that if they walked, they could find empty seats at another school, not to come back to the school.
So he basically threatened them of dismissal from the school if they were to walk out.
Right.
You met with the principal this morning, right?
I did.
How did you feel when you first heard that your kid wasn't allowed to go out?
I was upset because I did not understand. At that point, I did not understand why he would have such a harsh reaction. I was upset.
But you met this morning. Were there other parents?
I am not. There were other parents, all the parents. He called all the parents in to explain his point of view, which I thought was fair. He also explained it to the students who had walked, and on Wednesday, there is a town meeting, and at the town meeting next week, he will explain to the kids why he felt it necessary to, I guess, shock them into staying in the school.
Basically threaten them of dismissal.
Right.
So what did he say?
He had a number of points. His main concern was the safety of the children, since they are his responsibility during school hours. The other thing is that he strongly believes that using school as a means of protest sort of diminishes the importance of school. He feels if kids start walking out to protest against the war, which he believes is fine, you know, they have run bus trips down to Washington, D.C. for the protest, he believes that where does it stop? Will they start walking for police brutality? Do they stop walking for, you know, any number of issues are worth protesting?
Students across the world have been walking historically out on school to show the importance of a point. I mean, it, on the contrary, always had meant, I remember when I was a student, it would meant for us that school that's so precious, we walk out on it to protest something that even should take precedence.
Right. And I agree with you there. I'm just saying what his point of view was, is that he is responsible for those children, and he, as the authority figure, had to take appropriate action. Now, in the future, they'll do things like have teach-ins, like they do up at Hunter High School, you know, where they explain the issues, the pros, the cons, fact-finding, et cetera, which I think would be very effective.
Peggy Werns, a parent, speaking to Reem Kathuda of Pacifica Station WPFW. Well, President Bush made his case for a war in Iraq to the rest of the world on September 12th when he addressed the United Nations General Assembly in New York. We present now this creative expression of what he really said as analyzed by the technicians in the Department of Corrections musical collective. The piece is entitled Crush, Kill, Destroy.
Crush, kill.
President, distinguished delegates, and ladies and gentlemen, we've accomplished much in the last year. We have taken innocent lives in Afghanistan and beyond. We have brought grief to many citizens of our world, and our responsibilities are clear. But the purposes of the United States should not be doubted. To extend trade and the prosperity it brings, and to prove to the world its legitimacy. Today, the United States is a grave and gathering danger and continues to develop weapons of mass destruction and expanding facilities capable of producing chemical weapons in their most lethal and aggressive forms. To suggest otherwise is to hope against the evidence. To assume this regime's good faith is to bet the lives of millions and the peace of the world in a reckless gamble by the might of coalition forces and long-range missiles. My nation will threaten the world with mass murder. And that's important today to remember. The United States continues to shelter and support terrorist organizations and Al-Qaeda terrorists that direct violence against the people of the United States. The United States is a threat to the authority of the United Nations and a threat to peace. The United States has contempt for the United Nations and for all its pledges. By breaking every pledge, the United States will have new power to bully and dominate and conquer. The United States has no law of morality. The United States of America continues to commit extremely grave violations of human rights. Tens of thousands of political opponents and ordinary citizens have been subjected to arbitrary arrest and imprisonment, summary execution, and torture by beating and burning, electric shock, starvation, mutilation, and rape. Right now, Kuwaiti, Saudi, Indian, Syrian, Lebanese, Iranian, Egyptian, Bahraini, and Omani nationals remain unaccounted for. More than 600 people cast aside without consequence in cells and camps with little hope of freedom. And all of these horrors concealed from the world by the apparatus of a totalitarian state.
Crush, Kill, Destroy was produced by The Man, music provided by T. Opperman, courtesy of the Sydney, Australia IMC. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.